Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and we're going to continue with a discussion of not only, on the one hand, the descent into fascism, but also, in particular, similarities between, on the one hand, legislation that is either being proposed or is actually on the books in some places for dealing with people that the Third Reich called asocials. That's a wide-ranging definition, as we saw in our last segment. It applies to the homeless, unwed mothers, or any kind of other people that the Third Reich found distasteful, and that sadly a lot of people in contemporary America find distasteful. As I record this, in early August of 1995, sadly the United States is taking on the appearance of sliding down the same road that Germany went down in the 1920s and 30s. In our last segment, we examined a very fine article from the History Today magazine of July of 1995 about Hassjüde. That was described as sort of an SS halfway program to the concentration camps, and it was halfway to the camps. It was a 1936 SS project for housing and correcting so-called asocials. It was a controlled, surveilled housing project for people that were either very poor or viewed as having bad work habits. And as I noted in an analysis of that article, there are some very disturbing similarities between not only the political and social climate of Germany in the 20s and 30s, but also the reaction on the part of the authorities to some of the conditions that obtain, in particular with regard to the people that were viewed by the Third Reich and sadly in contemporary America as so-called asocials. In a discussion of homeless people, beggars, etc., in the History Today from July of 1995 article, we took a look at the phenomenon of people of relative modest means putting pressure on the government to deal with beggars, large numbers of poor and homeless people in urban areas. And this was described by the author of the article, Lisa Pine, as pressure, quote, coming from below. In other words, these were not members of the elite pushing for doing something about the homeless problem, but rather people who were relatively far down on the social ladder, middle class or below. And as I said, sadly, I think that there are some disturbing similarities between Germany in the 20s and 30s and the United States in 1995. As I said in the first segment, I'm not suggesting that this is a precise analogy, but I think it is a valid one. And an important one. By way of assessing some of the similarities between the conditions obtaining in Weimar and early Nazi Germany and conditions obtaining now in the United States, we're going to read an op-ed column from the San Jose Mercury News from Tuesday, May 30th of 1995. This is an article by Austin Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, of Marysville. Actually, Austin Lewis of the Pacific News Service. It's Dateline Marysville. Austin Lewis is a Pacific News Service correspondent who lives in Marysville, and it's entitled, Towns Are Declaring War on the Homeless. It reads, Homeless people beware. Country hospitality isn't what it used to be. In this Northern Californian town of 12,000, the traditional blue-collar philanthropy of feeding a hobo a sandwich on the back porch has given way to a lynch mob mentality. Indeed, notes Eileen Jacobs, attorney for the California Rural Legal Assistance Office here, small rural towns are less homeless-friendly than metropolitan areas. When some Marysville merchants complained to the city council about a homeless man sleeping in a parking lot, the vice mayor told them, quote, paint him yellow and use him as a speed bump, unquote. In recent months, the city council has considered various solutions to the homeless problem, including, quote, greyhound therapy, unquote, rounding up indigents and busing them to Sacramento, the nearest largest city 45 miles to the south. Making it illegal to give money to panhandlers, closing down the one homeless family shelter and soup kitchen for indigent people, saying they are magnets for transients, fencing both sides of the railroad tracks, making it impossible for hobos to get off freight trains, and keeping the sprinklers on at night in city parks. Marysville's war on the homeless echoes campaigns being waged in dozens of cities across America, notes the Washington, D.C. Coalition on the Homeless. The irony is that Marysville is so poor itself. Quote, we rank 56th out of 58 California counties with a median income of $13,794, says Connie Lewin, L-E-W-I-N, director of Yuba County Department of Social Services, again quoting, and we have very high rates of unemployment, child abuse, and the highest per capita rate of domestic violence, unquote. The county, located in agricultural Sacramento Valley, is filled with acres of peach, prune, and walnut orchards, vast rice fields, and other field crops. Despite this agricultural abundance, hunger is common in Marysville. Quote, "You find lots of health and nutrition problems here, and most people need food stamps to put food on their tables," unquote, says Jacobs. Again quoting, "You won't find alternatives like soup kitchens and food banks here that you'll see in urban areas." Quote, "While rents and mortgages tend to be cheaper than in cities," she adds, "when you look at what people earn, rents are not affordable here," unquote. Getting subsidized housing can mean being on a waiting list for years. As for health care, the county has few clinics, and the ones that do exist can't meet the demand. Since most doctors in the area do not accept Medi-Cal patients, or the treatment is not covered by Medi-Cal, many people lack access to adequate health care. Rather than creating a climate of mutual sympathy, however, the poverty of the region has heightened class divisions between the near poor and the poor. This last sentence again, because I think it's critical in understanding some of the similarities between contemporary America and Germany in the 20s and 30s. Rather than creating a climate of mutual sympathy, however, the poverty of the region has heightened class divisions between the poor and the near poor. Again, interrupting in the July 1995 Hashuda article from History Today, the statement was made that often the pressure for dealing with the homeless, transients, so-called asocials, came from below. Continuing with the San Jose Mercury News op-ed column from 5/30/95. Even though most people in the county are far from affluent, the difference in social status from just having a little more than your neighbors, let alone a home, is all important, notes Jackie Travis, Yuba County Health Services Director. Quote, "There's also a conservative take-care-of-yourself attitude and little sympathy when a family falls into destitution," unquote. When the working poor talk about the homeless, it's kind of like they're saying, quote, "We're one step above them, so we're okay," unquote, says Jim Rhodes, director of the one homeless family shelter serving Yuba and Sutter Counties. Marysville Mayor Jim Kitchen plays down any special animosity toward the city's poorest residents. What the city is trying to do is to protect its businesses, he says. Quote, "The major problem is simply the number of transients who hang around in front of businesses. People feel threatened and go other places to do their shopping. They give us a bad image and reduce our sales tax revenue and make the city less attractive for new businesses." Jeanette West, owner of Gold Rush Pizza, is more vocal in her condemnation of the homeless. Quote, "Some of these people could work. I've seen them run across my parking lot to hit my customers up for spare change. They're using the shelter to eat and sleep and then go around town begging for money to buy alcohol," unquote. Jacobs sees it differently. Quote, "In this country right now, we're in a cycle of blaming the victim. I don't know that there is any more hostility in a small town than a big one, but it seems to have more of a forum here," unquote. Jacobs, who spent years working for Washington's National Housing Law Project and Baltimore's Legal Aid Bureau before moving here 9 years ago, thinks homeless and destitute people in major metropolitan areas should think twice about moving to a small town. Quote, "Considering everything, they're probably better off where they are," unquote. Again, note the pressure from local business people to do something about the homeless. "My fear is that in the event of an economic collapse, and I think one is altogether possible, I don't know when, maybe in 6 months, maybe in 20 years, then the pressure to deal with the so-called asocials, whether they're unwed mothers, homeless, or others, is going to increase, and I think it is possible that America might see a Holocaust of sorts itself. I would not rule out the possibility of unwanted people, unwanted social strata, being eliminated one way or another. We should remember that fascism is not something alien to the United States. For the duration of the broadcast, I'm going to read a section of a book that I read periodically on my home base station in Northern California in order to give people an idea of what it was like subjectively to live through the Hitler period. And people should evaluate contemporary America and see the extent to which the things that are being described in the passage I'm going to read to you apply to the conditions in which they exist. The book is called They Thought They Were Free, subtitled The Germans, 1933 through 45. It's authored by Milton Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R. It's published in a soft cover by the Chicago University Press, copyrighted 1955. And in a chapter called But Then It Was Too Late, the author Milton Mayer interviews a university professor who was opposed to Hitler. And in this chapter, we hear from this university professor, quote, "What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. And their sense of identification with Hitler, their trust in him, made it easier to widen this gap and reassure those who would otherwise have worried about it." Interrupting, just think about how much people trusted a nice, smiling Ronald Reagan and went down the primrose path to the present situation in which we are the world's biggest debtor nation. That descent being conducted by the Reagan and Bush administrations under the banner of fiscal conservatism. Returning to "They Thought They Were Free," quote, "This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter." Quote, "You will understand me when I say that my middle high German was my life. It was all I cared about. I was a scholar, a specialist. Then suddenly I was plunged into all the new activity as the university was drawn into the new situation. Meetings, conferences, interviews, ceremonies, and above all papers to be filled out, reports, bibliographies, lists, questionnaires. And on top of that were the demands in the community, the things in which one had to, quote, was expected to, unquote, participate that had not been there or had not been important before. It was all rigmarole, of course, but it consumed all one's energies coming on top of the work one really wanted to do. You can see how easy it was then not to think about fundamental things. One had no time." Unquote. Those, I said, are the words of my friend the baker. One had no time to think. There was so much going on. Unquote. "Your friend the baker was right," said my colleague. "The dictatorship and the whole process of its coming into being was above all diverting. It provided an excuse not to think for people who did not want to think anyway. I do not speak of your little men, your baker, and so on. I speak of my colleagues and myself, learned men, mind you. Most of us did not want to think about fundamental things and never had. There was no need to. Nazism gave us some dreadful, fundamental things to think about. We were decent people and kept us so busy with continuous changes and crises and so fascinated, yes, fascinated with the machinations of the national enemies, quote-unquote, without and within, that we had no time to think about these dreadful things that were growing little by little all around us. Unconsciously, I suppose, we were grateful. Who wants to think? To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us have had ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion, quote, regretted, unquote, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures, unquote, that no, quote, patriotic German, unquote, could resent must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, it is over his head. How is this to be avoided? Among ordinary men, even highly educated ordinary men? Frankly, I do not know. I do not see even now. Many, many times since it all happened, I have pondered that pair of great maxims, Principus obsta and finem respis, resist the beginnings and consider the end. But one must foresee the end in order to resist or even see the beginnings. One must foresee the end clearly and certainly. And how is this to be done by ordinary men or even by extraordinary men? Things might have changed here before they went as far as they did. They didn't, but they might have. And everyone counts on that might. your little men, your Nazi friends who are not against National Socialism, and your little men, your Nazi friends were not against National Socialism in principle. Men like me who were are the greater offenders, not because we knew better, that would be too much to say, but because we sensed better. Pastor Niemöller spoke for thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke, too modestly of himself, and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist, and so he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier, but still he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the schools, the press, the Jews, and so on, and he was always uneasier, but still he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something, but then it was too late, unquote. Yes, I said. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble, unquote. Why not? Well, you are not in the habit of doing it. And it is not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, quote, everyone, unquote, is happy. One hears no protest and certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there would be slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. In Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps there is not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do, but what do they say? They say, it's not so bad, or you're seeing things, or you're an alarmist, unquote. And you are an alarmist. You are saying that this must lead to this, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know, or even surmise, the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. You are left with your close friends who are naturally people who have always thought as you have. But your friends are fewer now. Some have drifted off somewhere or submerged themselves in their work. You no longer see as many as you did at meetings or gatherings. Informal groups become smaller, attendance drops off in little organizations, and the organizations themselves wither. Now, in small gatherings of your oldest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you are isolated from the reality of things. This weakens your confidence still further, and serves as a further deterrent to what? It is clear all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it. And then you are obviously a troublemaker. So you wait, and you wait. But the one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds or thousands will join with you never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, yes, millions would have been sufficiently shocked if, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than Step B, and if you do not make a stand at Step B, why should you at Step C? And so on to Step D. And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case my little boy, hardly more than a baby saying, Jew swine, collapses it all at once. And you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. The system itself could not have intended this in the beginning, but in order to sustain itself, it was compelled to go all the way. You have gone almost all the way yourself now. Life is a continuing process, a flow, not a succession of acts and events at all. It has flowed to a new level, carrying you with it without any effort on your part. On this new level you live, you have been living more comfortably every day with new morals, new principles. You have accepted things you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things that your father, even in Germany, could not have imagined. Suddenly, it all comes down, all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or more accurately, what you haven't done. For that was all that was required of most of us, that we do nothing. You remember those early meetings of your department in the university when if one had stood, others would have stood perhaps, but no one stood. A small matter, a matter of hiring this man or that, and you hired this one rather than that. You remember everything now, and your heart breaks. Too late. You are compromised beyond repair. And again, I think people should evaluate the statements made by this university professor, in particular the fact that he notes that each step is just not that much worse than the step that went before. It acclimates one to going along with the program rather quietly. And if you do not protest at step A, why protest at B, and so on to C, all the way through to Z? This is why I think it is very important to consider the disturbing similarities between programs, social programs, laws that are either being proposed in the United States or are already on the books in some cases, and similar acts and legislation that obtained in Nazi Germany in the pre-World War II period, in the case of Hashüde, in 1936. I also think it's very important to consider how this society might react in the event of an economic collapse, as we have seen in numerous archive documentaries, and I'll tell people where they can obtain those later in this program, or actually in just a couple of minutes. We have discussed the fact that fascism is not something alien to the United States. Many of this country's most powerful industrialists and financiers, many of its political figures, many national security operatives were and are, frankly, pro-Nazi and pro-fascist. This was true in the pre-World War II and World War II period, and sadly it's true today. This is not to say that all or even most of the people in our national security establishment or in industry and finance are of fascist inclinations. Many are fine and honorable men and women. But unfortunately, there is a very powerful and a pivotal Nazi and fascist element in this country. This has been true for a long time. The American fascists were never purged. There was no Nuremberg trial for American industrialist financiers, political and national security figures who were pro-Nazi and pro-fascist. And indeed, at the end of World War II, this country incorporated many of the most heinous elements of the Third Reich's national security establishment into its own in order to use against the Soviet Union during the Cold War. All of which is to say that I do not necessarily know how the American people will react in the event of a social crisis stemming from an economic collapse. It would not surprise me, however, if this country were to respond to a social crisis by going fascist. And again, I think the drift into fascism, the gradual descent into fascism, going from step A to step B to step C and step D, just as the university professor related and they thought they were free, is something which is evident in contemporary American society. It is something that should be halted. Otherwise, we may not be at the halfway point to the concentration camps, as the author termed the Hashüde article. We may go all the way ourselves now, as the university professor said in They Thought They Were Free. Now, I alluded to the archive shows a little earlier. The archive shows are a form of radio documentary that I've put together over the years in which the printed sources upon which the lines of argument presented on this broadcast are based are read on the air, literally extracted on the air, so that listeners can tape the programs and then use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. All of these archive shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication service. More about that right now.
Tape cassettes of Dave Emery's archive documentaries and weekly One Step Beyond programs are available from a tape duplication service. The service is Archives on Audio, and you can contact them at Post Office Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. Once again, that's P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number and area code are 415-346-1840. A 12-page catalog listing and describing each archive show is available. Neither Dave Emery nor KFJC make money from the sale of the tapes.
Again, that's the information for Archives on Audio. By the way, KFJC-FM is the home base station from which I make these broadcasts. And, by the way, note that there is now a new catalog out that is 20 pages in length. As I said, KFJC is the home base station in Northern California on which I record these broadcasts. KFJC has its own web page on the World Wide Web. The catalog, including the descriptions of the broadcasts and the cross-referencing of the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material, is available on the KFJC webpage. You can obtain that, or you can access that, as follows.
KFJC is available on the World Wide Web. Simply point your web browser at http://www.cygnus.com/misc/KFJC. Spelling that out for you using all lowercase letters, http://www.cygnus.com/misc/KFJC. We remain your source for sound information.
That again for information about how to access the KFJC-FM webpage, with all of the archive show descriptions, cross-references, also a suggested reading list, and recommendations for other sources to obtain a similar material. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.